Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support. One way to support us for free is to think of us when you're shopping on Amazon.com. You can go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and click on the button at the top right of our right sidebar. That gives us a percentage of what you spend without any cost to you. You can also support us at patreon.com for as little as $1 a month. And if you decide to become a partiallyexaminedlife.com member, or what we like to call a citizen, at $5 a month, you can participate in discussion groups with other listeners and get unlimited access to ad-free episodes and paid content from a single, convenient feed that can be used with a variety of podcast apps.
Thanks to everyone that became a Partially Examined Life citizen since we aired part one of this interview. We had a drawing from among those new citizens for a free copy of the book, and the winner was Tim Markham. We also drew another name from the people that went on our Facebook page and liked the post for the episode. The winner of that was Jasper Silver. And then we gave away two more copies, drawing from the full, active, Partially Examined Life citizenry. The winners there were Marcus Richeson and Matt Cole. Again, we really appreciate your support, and are going to try to do more drawings like this in the future as a way of saying thank you. Hey, this is the Partially Examined Life, episode 144, part 3. We previously just had a great interview with Martha Nussbaum that you should definitely go listen to before listening to this, but we wanted to have a little more discussion of her book, Anger and Forgiveness, without her talking so much. So that was a great interview, though it was an interview and not a discussion so much, though she did eventually let our questions go on for as long as we wanted them to. Whereas at the beginning, she would just jump in after a sentence. So what are the questions that you all want to make sure that we cover here? For me, there were two elements that I felt like we needed to weigh in on. One was, we all read this chapter 6 on the political realm, Everyday Justice, but we didn't really talk about those as policy proposals. What does this dedication to non-anger mean in terms of constructing policies about punishment, or really just how to do with wrongdoing? What do we think of that? She kind of wades into a really broad debate and brings up a bunch of other figures that I'm sure not going to really go into. It'd be nice to give a little outline of that. And then the other thing was just, what do we think of this as a self-improvement practice, or following up on our discussion of Seneca and other folks like that? So those were my two agenda items. Do you have other things to add?
Mark, I think those are two good places. I think the second one might be leavened by a little bit of talking about the theoretical underpinnings. That is, in the picture of the self and the self's relationship with the community. We talked a little bit about it during the interview.
I have some ideas about the importance of this notion of status injury, and I think there's a weak spot in their argument there.
I guess a third possible issue that I just want to point at is just, what do we think about her project as a way of analyzing emotions? What is her theory of emotions? Is this the kind of thing a philosopher should be doing?
Well, of course it's something a philosopher should be doing, right? It's something a philosopher should be doing because a philosopher is interested about understanding the world.
Yeah, she should. But I think in this case, there should have been more psychology, I think, in order to really get at what anger is. And that's where the porthole into the psychology of it is this whole idea of status injury, which she doesn't really, as far as I can tell, adequately define status in the book. And she's referring, when she talks about status injury, to something that Aristotle actually calls slighting. I mean, she uses the word slighting as well, or downranking. She uses all of these as synonyms. And Aristotle in the Rhetoric does precisely define slighting as basically demonstrating to someone else that something that they think is important is not in fact important. But I think status is a little misleading, because when we think of social status, we think of our sort of ranking by social reputation, whether it's professional standing or social standing or wealth or power, things like that. But this idea of being slighted, it doesn't depend on anyone knowing about it. If I go into a store and the shopkeeper is rude to me and I feel slighted by that, it doesn't matter if anyone else finds out about that. It's not about reputation.
It's about self-esteem.
It is exactly about self-esteem. And she mentions that, and then she sort of, I think it's Hampton, another philosopher, who sort of points in that direction and then dismisses that without saying why. And I understand that's not really what she wanted to focus on.
But I think that she meant to have that definition there, right? In the normal status, in the sense of the status that other people would pick up on, or that would be public, would be included under there. And she certainly meant the kind of anger that you would get, as you say, from being slighted or disrespected, or in the fact, like, you're sitting in your car by yourself and someone cuts you off. Part of what the origin of road rage would be, exactly that kind of slighting or status injury that, again, is not, I agree with you, it's not public. I'm not sure that, though, it's the same thing as self-esteem. It certainly has something to do with one's self-understanding. And I guess it's however respect works that you get angry when somebody disrespects you.
Or it should disrespect something that you actually value. So
both, yes, both those things, yes.
She disagrees with Aristotle in that she doesn't think that slighting is sort of an essential part of the concept of anger. It's one form of it.
Yep.
And I agree with Aristotle. I think slighting is actually at the essence of anger. There is no anger without slighting. There is no anger without disrespect.
Okay.
So psychoanalysts would, I think, call this narcissistic injury. That if you really want to explore anger, that's the direction you have to go. That's my point. There are other things here as well. I mean, it really changes some of the analysis. So, for instance, when she talked about the rape of O and Angela's friend feels slighted by it, she sort of analyzed that in terms of Angela's irrational fantasy that the perpetrator must believe that Angela wasn't capable of defending her friend and that there's an ego wound from that. But really, your ego can be wounded just directly by someone harming the things that you value. Because those things, and this is the telling use of Aristotle of, you know, our own, we see those things as extensions of ourselves. We don't need this other sort of explanation to understand why someone can feel slighted by a friend being raped. The slight is in someone treating something that you value as if it has no value. And then, you know, there's a deeper psychology to, well, why would our self-esteem be affected by one person doing one thing? And I think there's a deep psychology to that. And not to get into that today, I don't want to derail our conversation, but that's the direction that I think needs a lot of exploration. And it changes, although I agree with most of her political conclusions, I think it changes a little bit how we think about those things, how we think of the role of anger in justice and politics. Anyway, that's the only agenda that I had.
So she thinks that anger inevitably involves attribution of ill intent against someone else, which makes me immediately think, well, what about frustration? Just like we were talking in the Simone de Beauvoir episode about, can obstacles oppress you? Like when it feels like your computer is oppressing you because it's not behaving. Well, I get angry at my computer in kind of the same way. In fact, more freely, because I know the computer is not have an actual ill will, because kind of as you're saying, it's a matter of when I'm involved in a project, I'm just trying to send this damn email out and something jumps in the way and interferes with that. That is an attack on something that at that moment, at least, is part of myself, is something that I'm placing value. I'm placing my effort into it. And so it actually does feel like a personal slight. I feel like the world is against me. You know, all this kind of crap.
It does, yeah. And I think in this case, Nussbaum has an analysis that's correct, which is that we treat those objects as if they were people. We sort of have an irrational and maybe unconscious idea, a sort of primitive animism, which we never grow out of on some level, that there's intentionality in these things. And that when they are obstacles to us, like a person who doesn't value what we value.
But this makes me wonder if the not valuing what we value is quite right.
Sorry, that's actually the wrong way to put it. Because they don't have to value what they value, we value. They just have to respect the fact that we value something and not treat it as if it were of no value, for instance. They don't have to feel fondly. Perpetrator doesn't have to feel fondly about Angela's friend O, doesn't have to care about her, and doesn't even have to refrain from having like violent fantasies towards her. But he does have to have that state of mind, that respect that implies that she has a value which prohibits him from raping her.
So the case of inanimate objects, which it seems like we're analyzing right, but makes me think of the question of in the, you know, the phenomenology and source of anger is different as being related to power and to things doing what you want them to do or behaving in the way you want or expect them to do. And there's clearly a relationship in that with seeing the world as I see it, or the world being in alignment with the way I'm imagining it or I expect it to be. But that's different to me than self-esteem. I'm being thwarted in a different way than being downranked, except insofar as that I have lost my power over the world or over another person as a result of it. And especially, I've lost that power unwillingly.
Yeah, it is kind of a stretch to say, well, the self is expandable to include anything that I value, and then anything that's an attack on something in that sphere is an attack on the self. Well, yes, by the definition of self that you just gave, but interpreting all that as narcissism or something.
I don't think you get anger unless you get this imperilment of the ego, let's say, unless you have this ego wounding. What is the real object of our anger in the case of rape or murder? Someone dies from a mudslide, and we're not angry about that unless we can find someone to blame, because we don't get angry at mud because it doesn't have any intentions.
But we do get angry.
Well, yeah, but only insofar as we're thinking of the mud as like a in some irrational way. And generally, I don't, you know, if I read about a mudslide in the paper, I'm not angry at the mudslide. If I read about a murder, I might get angry. So the focus is really on this type of intention, the mind of the murderer and them not valuing something that is inherently valuable. And that is threatening to us because, think of Hegel, our self-awareness, our self is intimately tied to the recognition of others. We are sort of constituted through the recognition, and developmentally, this is pretty obvious, right? To become aware of myself and love myself, I have to internalize the love and awareness of an early caretaker. And I remain connected in general to people in that way. These sorts of slights are actually, at a deeper level, threats to psychic existence. And I know that needs more justification. I'm not going to give it in the podcast, but that is the basic idea.
And we can move on. The question that I have about that is, the question of power seems to be different than the sense of self-understanding there.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, by wanting to exert my understanding upon the world, the way you're phrasing it, and there's part of that that sounds quite right, that being disrespected has to do with not having your own values, your own self-understanding validated, right? It's why being utterly ignored is so painful and anger-producing. And on that analysis, then we would say, well, the reason why Mark gets so angry at his computer and eventually throws it through the window is because the computer is not acknowledging him. And the way it's not acknowledging him is that it's not doing what he says. And it's that step, that it's not behaving in a way that's in alignment with what you want to have happen, that to me muddies the waters a bit. That it's certainly that alignment, but it also has to do with what you're trying to get out of it, your power on it. And so when your kids make you so angry, or when the person at the checkout counter or on the phone with the phone company makes you so angry, it's often even not even because they don't understand what you need. It's because they're not doing what you want them to do. And it's not that they're ignoring the fact that you exist. No, you exist and they're interacting with you, but they're just not doing what you want them to do.
So Nussbaum gives the example of the store clerk who ignores you. They're on the phone and you get angry because you feel disrespected. But if you know there's something important behind that, or that they're not doing it intentionally, you don't get angry. So I think it's true that at some level, you really have to think of someone as intentionally doing something wrong in order to get angry at them. I think Nussbaum is also right about that. She sort of captures some of this in the idea of wrongdoing, but I see respect and slighting as sort of the moral psychology of wrongdoing. So as part of her concept of anger, we have to see something as doing something wrong, but we know from Kant and other philosophers that respect and wrongdoing and what we ought to do are intimately connected, right? Respecting other people as ends in themselves is intimately connected to what it means to do something wrong. So there is this, she sort of does capture it, but I think if you really want to analyze the moral psychology of all that, you have to go in the direction of respect and slighting and all that.
Okay. One thing, Mark posed the question of wanting to delve more into you know, what's the underlying theory of emotions and stuff like that. And we did a little bit of talking about that just now as far as anger was concerned, but it's worth pointing out that this is one book among a number on specific emotions. And then she has a whole analysis of emotion called Upheaval of Thought. So in some sense, answering that question requires us reading a different book. There's a section in this book that summarizes that. And she talked a little bit about that during the interview. It's sort of what parts of that theoretical analysis of emotion that she is working with. But she points out that the anger book doesn't rely deeply on all of the points of her analysis of emotion.
Just looking at her theory of emotions, it's not supposed to be a psychological theory. It's supposed to be a theory. This is sort of what the role of the philosopher is, of analyzing the underlying internal logic of the emotion. So as we said, it's not non-cognitive. There are judgments involved, and some of these are factual judgments. I'm angry at this person because they did such and such. She's saying there is an attribution of some agency. To me, on a daily basis, anger is connected with frustration. So like, I'm just as likely and more likely to get angry at my computer or at traffic or whatever and generalize it so that I'm more angry at the world thwarting me than at individual people who I really, for the most part, am good about giving the benefit of the doubt for and not demonizing. Still, I'll just grant her that the kind of anger she's talking about involves blaming someone, and frustration would be a different but related thing. She discusses other things like contempt, you know, so she has a mapping. So for instance, anger focuses on an act that a person commits, whereas contempt might have a similar desire to downrank, but be focused on an enduring trait of a person. That's the kind of analysis that she gives. So there's matters of fact. Did this person actually commit a crime? And then there are values that are built into the normative assessments that are in emotion. This person deserves payback. So it's those latter things that she feels like, as a species of moral philosophy, this is what the analysis of emotions is supposed to do. Unless you are a foundationalist about ethics and think, oh, we can just, from the categorical imperative, we can get everything, or some other sort of basic, from what the Bible says, we can get anything. If you're a secularist, you have to believe that when we're figuring out moral theory, we've got just all these intuitions floating around. Yeah, some of them are personal. All of them are, to some extent, probably come from a particular cultural background. Some might have a biological basis. And we just have to juggle these and figure out, like, well, which of these... So she says, just moving our discussion to the political realm, you know, a lot of our political institutions and our deep intuitions about punishment, say, rely on this idea of payback. But the fact that it's such a deep and pervasive intuition does not mean it's something we should normatively respect, something that we actually want to enshrine as policy, something that we should respect and think is useful as a personal emotion.
Yes, that's exactly what she says.
So she gives a lot of pretty specific recommendations in the political realm.
There were some recommendations in the political realm, but I thought that she acknowledged in many places that once you take the rethinking of punishment, especially taking seriously the notion that it's rightly not payback, takes you very quickly down the road of thinking about broader social good and how to engineer that in society. And that gets you thinking about what are the contributing factors to why individuals or groups of individuals commit crimes, are socially problematic. And that has to do with trying to address those at the beginning. That is essentially to make the conditions of living in the community broadly understood as supporting the flourishing of as many people as possible. And that's why she talks about things like, she just brings them up as, well, you'd rethink education and social support for families and nutrition and all kinds of things that would go towards creating an environment for people's flourishing, because on her analysis, a tremendous amount of the criminality and deviancy has to do with people just not becoming who they can be.
So on page 180, she has this comparison of the focus on punishment as a way of addressing human misbehavior. She says, let us consider elevators. A traveler to a distant country finds that elevators are very unreliable.
Exactly.
They are often badly constructed and maintained, and they break down often. There are no laws about elevators, no mandatory inspections, no licensing or certification. Never mind, her hosts inform her. We don't spend money on such things, but we do spend a great deal of money tracking down the offenders, and we give them long prison sentences at state expense to show them what we think their bad behavior deserves. In other words, the elevator manufacturers.
Oh, really? I thought it was the elevators themselves.
No, no, it's the elevator manufacturers and the people, and the people who operate and maintain the elevators.
Right? We will travel and look at all the floors and see where that elevator has disappeared to catch it. Our traveler would be justified in thinking this a very odd and irrational society, and one that at some level did not take the whole issue of human safety seriously. And she says that's really how societies treat most crimes.
Yep.
The neglect is even stranger in that criminals, unlike elevators, are equal citizens among those whose welfare society is committed to protect and advance.
I think she really does mean the elevators when she's talking about tracking down and for the whole metaphor to work. I mean, it's an absurd example, but it's supposed to get at this difference between, because they're inanimate objects, we think of them purely constructively. Okay, how do we fix this?
That might be right, and it might make the analogy even sweeter in its absurdity. But I think that it's not so hard to make a slightly different twist of that analogy and say, well, the way you're going to ensure elevator safety or car safety is that every time there is a failure, you're going to go out and take the engineer and you're going to tie them to a stake and flog them until they make it so it works. We don't do that.
So as a matter of, you know, deterrence and that sort of thing, that probably helps, right? To punish, you know, if someone does something wrong at a car company where they obscure some defect and people die because of that. And
we deter through crime the things where they lie about what they said they did. And this is how companies work all the time. So, for instance, with safety belts on cars, you know, people weren't thrown in jail for not having safety belts. What they said is they said, all those people are dying in cars, and you say it's because the cars are unsafe and they ought to have safety belts. And you're saying that we should do that. But that's not part of policy. We don't have to have those safety belts. It's up to people to drive correctly until there's a policy put in place that requires that there be certain standards of safety involved. Same thing's true with OSHA. Same thing's true with all kinds of environmental regulations or manufacturing regulations, is that the way the company operates is that as long as they say what they're doing, then they are doing something honestly. All the punishments involve things like VW. We said we're going to be emitting low values of toxic chemicals out of our cars, but you know what? We tricked the test, and so we actually lied to you. That part is punished all the time.
And there is this borderline area of gross negligence and all that, which is punished. But my point is that bringing in the engineers muddies the water on this example, because what we're really talking about is we don't think it's a constructive way to deal with elevators, right, to punish them. We want to fix them. And we ought to think the same way about human beings who need fixing, right? We should just fix them. But the whole idea of punishing them is completely irrelevant to the well-being of society.
Yeah.
Hey, before we go further, let's stop and talk about our sponsor, Dylan.
Like so many of you, we're always looking for ways to learn and challenge ourselves for the pure pleasure of it. And we have found that with the Great Courses Plus, which is why we keep encouraging you to sign up too. The Great Courses Plus gives you unlimited access to learn from award-winning professors and experts about whatever interests you, whatever you want. There are hundreds of fascinating topics to explore: philosophy, religion, history, even photography. And these short, on-demand video lectures fit easily into your schedule. Stream them anytime. Start and resume from any device. We've been watching the course Modern Intellectual Tradition, which has been right up my alley, noting that our modern world, really, the past 400 years, has been deeply influenced by the developments of the new sciences of mathematical physics and evolutionary biology, the new political structure of liberal democracy, and new market economics and capitalism, all of which are also changing and developing over that time. I really like the exploration of these themes through the inquiry and thought of philosophers from Descartes to Hegel to Wittgenstein to Rorty, particularly how Professor Colquhoun stays attentive to the many connections between the philosophers themselves, their culture, and their times. I'm very much looking forward to making my way through the rest of the course. We want you to sign up so you can start streaming courses like this too. Right now, as one of our listeners, sign up for The Great Courses Plus, and you'll immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of their lectures. Take advantage of the special opportunity now. Start your free month by signing up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
Yep, and you have to spell it the plus, PLUS. All right, let's get back to the discussion. So she doesn't say this explicitly in this book, but it did occur to me, this is in line with exactly what you're talking about. So one of the first people she picks on in the book, brings up, is Peter Strawson and his reactive attitude. So I'll just point people back to our free will episode. And so I couldn't help but think of this chapter as trying to come up with a fair system of punishment that does not wrongly assume that people have free wills, right? The whole current emphasis on retributive punishment is you chose to do that bad thing, and so now we're going to punish you, and so other people will know if they choose. It's all focused on choice and sort of having to live with your choice. Some of the things she says makes it sound like maybe it's better to think that she wants to respect the fundamental ambiguity, putting Simone de Beauvoir's picture into Nussbaum's head here.
Yeah, exactly. Because we can be compatibilists here, which, you know, most philosophers today are, right? We can see people as the products of their circumstances, and yet in some certain sense, this limited sense that you get reason responsive and free in that sense. So.
Yes. So, of course, we're trying to make you into somebody who is better able to reason calmly, to respond
exactly,
to reason.
Exactly. You can become freer, in other words. Yeah.
And that's one feature of the book. She's not universalist in this respect. It's not either you either have a completely free will or no free will at all, or that the anger that you feel towards society or towards the bank clerk ought to be controlled and understood in exactly the same way as the anger you feel in an intimate betrayal or something like that. There may be something that it connects all of them, but it's not deeply universalist.
So just looking at some of the specific things she recommends, it's like you were saying, it has to be forward-looking, of course. So we're thinking about reforming the person. We're thinking about reintegrating them into society. We don't want to humiliate them. That doesn't help. Basically comes down to actually looking at evidence, looking at what works. So if you think that something is a deterrent, well, do studies and see whether that actually deters. If you think something will reform someone, do studies. So the way you determine whether something is cruel and unusual, or at least cruel, is looking at the effects. So she thinks just garden variety incarceration, which has never been really raised as that's cruel and unusual, that in fact might be certainly not, she doesn't really make a strong point for this, but raises it as a significant question. Maybe you can justify this on the grounds of separating the person from doing future harm to other people, but don't think this is going to reform them. Don't think this is going to help them.
Well, she's like Foucault in that respect, right? In his, we read Discipline and Punish, mm-hmm. right? And the notion that punishment for punishment's sake, punishment for payback, does nothing to change the person, reform the person. And I think you're right to reiterate her emphasis on being forward-looking, and that payback is all about looking backwards. And most incarceration, to the extent that it is a punishment meant to you get your just desserts, you're deprived of your freedom because you were a bad person, as opposed to you can't be part of society right now because you're not integrating with it right, and so we're going to try to sort that out. Those are two vastly different understandings of what incarceration does. Solitary confinement and the prevalence of solitary confinement is just a perfect example of an abomination of the way we would interact with other human beings and expect them to live. It's just an abomination.
It is torture.
Yes.
But do you guys remember Anders Breivik, this Norwegian guy who killed 77 kids on the island, you know? And so there's occasional news reports. He's given what we would consider a very light sentence, 21 years in prison, which is the maximum in Norway. And the prisons there are very nice. They're like apartments. And he complains about things like not having the latest Xbox or something like that. He's outraged by these human rights violations, that his apartment's not nice enough, and that all these amenities that he has are not up to date. I bring this up because Norway sort of has this model of incapacitation and reform focusing on those things. You could say there's some deterrent effect, right? Because no one likes to lose their freedom, even if the settings are nice. But it's hard, I think, for Americans to sort of wrap their, and probably a lot of Norwegians as well, to wrap their heads around that. Someone kills 77 kids and then he's sort of pampered. How do we deal with that uncomfortableness of that intuition? Or maybe it isn't uncomfortable to you guys, but.
Well, that gets us back to the real question of payback, right? So the reason that's uncomfortable is we feel like he should have to pay. So it comes down to the question, how are we dealing with that kind of thing? And is Martha Nussbaum right that payback ought not be any part of our justice system? So she extrapolates from saying that in the analysis of anger, that insofar as it involves payback, that is a true part of anger, but it is normally dysfunctional.
Well, and it's confused.
And it's confused. It doesn't make sense. Yes, exactly.
Right. She thinks that payback inevitably involves an imagined reparation for the damage that was done.
Except in the case of status, where it's not confused.
So you think that we want more for the mass killer, more harsh conditions because we want to lower his status? How could his status be any lower? He's known as this huge...
No, but that's why I think the word status is misleading. Think of it in this way, right? We make certain demands on the psyches of others for respect and for empathy. And what does empathy mean? It means that someone proactively feels, if they imagine harming us, they feel pain at that. And when we get payback from someone, we enforce empathy after the fact. We make them feel the pain related to the pain that they caused.
How's that empathy? That's not empathy.
No, it's not empathy, but it's a bastardized kind of form of it. And the sense in which it's a reversal, status is a misleading word. The reason why Nussbaum argues that in the cases of status, we actually do gain something by retaliating is that we restore our self-esteem. So by, although she's not using the word self-esteem, but we restore our status in some sense. So we show Breivik that he can't do this and get away with it. Or we show him that the thing that we thought important actually is important. We somehow prove it.
And then this is where the power thing that I was talking about comes in, right? We prove it by showing that we have more power over him than he has over us.
We prove it by making him feel things. We're making demands on the thoughts and feelings of other people, and we're trying to control those thoughts and feelings. We want to enforce that. If he doesn't have them of his own accord, we want to make him have them. That's really the significant thing here. That's the status reversal.
A little less extreme example, and when I was walking back to my car, I wish I had brought up to her, is very related to this, that you know, I play soccer with a bunch of over 40 guys, and it's remarkable how angry they can get at a little rec league game playing here in Madison, Wisconsin. But you'd swear sometimes it was the stakes were the World Cup and the glory was equivalent. And you know, one time I was playing and I was going hard after a ball and the goalie was going hard after it as well. And we ran into each other. And you get a little bit angry about the situation and we shook it off. And then later on, like, I don't know, 10 minutes later, I was going down in the box again and I had the ball and the goalie came up and ran at me and put his shoulder down and body checked me in the chest on purpose. So I was so pissed. So he did that to me because at the very least, his anger was such that he thought that I somehow had run into him on purpose before.
Or at least out of negligence or carelessness, which is also relevant.
Yeah. Yes. And so, and then he purposely does this to me. I got up, I was very, very angry, and I just walked off the field. And then afterwards, for days, I felt utterly self-shameful that I had not gone up and just clocked him. And I would have felt better if I had done that because of exactly what you just said, Wes, that I would have made him understand that I am not a fucking pushover. Mm-hmm. And that mattered to me. And that is a different kind of payback, right? It's not a payback of getting back what happened to me before. It's a pay forward, right? It's an assertion of power, an assertion of self, where I think you might be right, Wes, that I am trying to force that person to understand me and my position.
You want to prove your own value as a human being.
But the part where I want to say is that that act of me, say I went over and clocked him, right? I think I agree that I would be making an act to try to prove my own value as a human being. And maybe this all get tied up in manliness too.
Mm-hmm.
But What I wouldn't be doing is I wouldn't get his acknowledgement out of that, except insofar as he didn't get back up. And in fact, I wouldn't really care if he acknowledged in any way, even in himself, right? And that's one of the reasons why I was so angry myself, is I felt in that dynamic that he had won because I had simply walked off. And this is like the nub of why these things escalate, right? I'm still pissed about it.
Yeah. Although if you had done it, right, you would have felt, assuming there wasn't legal consequences, you would have felt kind of guilty and ashamed maybe of having done it. So it's sort of a catch-22 in that sense. And I've been there. I think the idea behind revenge, though, is that you do get some sort of acknowledgement. He thought you were lesser than him, and now you prove that he's lesser than you in some domain because you put him on the ground.
Yeah, so I found myself just wildly thinking about, well, what could I have done that would have made me assert myself in a way that didn't feel like it had the implication of being so cowardly? That's because that's part of what bothered me about it. I knew that the proper thing in that game was to not take it to the next level. It only hurt my team. It only hurt the situation. It wasn't going to do any good to go and do what he did, right?
Or there's a way to work it out as well, right? You yeah. could start by saying, did I do something to make you angry?
Yeah, I guess we could have talked.
You can sort of work people towards into a state of remorse gives you the same sort of satisfaction. It would have been very satisfying if you got him to realize that he harmed you and you got him to feel sorry about that. That would have been just as good a satisfaction as getting revenge.
You know what? You're right about that. You've studied psychology, haven't you?
See, I was going to try to figure out what Martha's response, and the only thing I was coming up with was playfulness. That's her, in the intimate realm at least, is the substitution, which in this would mean saying something snide instead of reacting physically, which is probably, if I had the guts to do anything, would be what I would do. But yeah, that's probably not any more constructive, and certainly her verdict on the whole thing is just that even though these things might feel good in the moment, like you were saying, it's kind of a catch-22, that de-escalation is the only sustainable way to solve these things. And so,
yeah.
I mean, you're already kind of getting at the second issue that I wanted to bring up in terms of what about this as a self-improvement practice? And she addresses this in the conclusion a little. It's kind of the same thing we were discussing when we were getting at the Stoics. Is it really psychologically possible to turn off anger, to do what she's recommending? Mm-hmm. For one thing, she has a much less strenuous set of recommendations in the Stoics. We don't, in a Jedi manner, withdraw from all personal involvement. She thinks that Stoicism in the personal realm just has no place at all. And she is not afraid of feeling grief. It's really simply these kinds of anger. And in fact, you know, transition anger that gets you toward looking at the future and doing something about it, being outraged that something has happened and wanting to do something about the general situation, not about correcting just your. So it's kind of like involves getting out of this trap of the ego to try to push things forward to a overall better situation.
Well, and that's the future-orientedness, right? I think that's right. Is that I think you understand what is meant by transition anger if you understand that it's always oriented towards the future.
The way both of you have been talking, Wes is kind of giving this psychoanalytic, which was a Freud's disciple that was Adler, that, you know, everything came down to esteem, rank, as opposed to Dylan is giving this kind of Nietzschean will to power. Both of these, if taken simply, are thoroughly determinist, saying we have to in some way get rid of this and become more peaceful. Like, well, no, that's what human nature is, according to the strong versions of these two
theories.
Yeah,
you don't get rid of anger. Also, anger is not in and of itself normatively problematic. Feelings aren't normatively problematic. I could say from a virtue ethic standpoint that having a certain disposition to be angry all the time and at the wrong thing would be a character flaw, right? There's a normative implication there. But a specific instance of anger cannot itself be normatively problematic. It's what I do with that, you know. Do I punch someone in the face? Do I write an unconstructive screed and post it online? Does the pattern of getting angry so often cause heart disease or fuck up my relationships or things like that? So those are the normatively problematic parts, but I don't think the having of a feeling per se can be normatively problematic. So that's one thing that a psychoanalyst would deny.
Where normativity really comes in is not when you're talking about at the individual level, but when you're talking about making it into a rule, making it into a moral or by extension, legal rule.
Yeah, like taking your anger and making a policy that's motivated by it. Yeah, like retribution.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, so. Yeah, forgiving honor-based killings. Like, you know, I was angry that my wife cheated on me, so I had to kill her and the guy. Like, no, that's not. And that, you know, is a legitimate thing to claim in some legal systems. And we don't buy that because we have followed her recommendation to that extent that we do not allow these things to be enshrined. And some other specific things that she brings up are victim statements at sentencing. She says, well, we already allow statements by the victims or victims' families that might mitigate the punishment. And she seems to think that's okay, although she doesn't really go on about that at all. She kind of just brings it up. But she goes on quite a bit about what would be the possible forward-looking function of allowing the relative of a murdered person to speak at the trial or sentencing of the person. They've already taken into account how awful this is and how this affects people around the murdered person in determining sentencing guidelines in the first place. And how harshly someone is sentenced shouldn't depend on how loved the victim was. Like, it's still, exactly. Even if it was a loser, loner, irascible bastard that was murdered, you shouldn't give a lighter sentence to the right. person because of that. So why right. would you possibly, the only possible good effect would be maybe allowing the person to vent. And so she suggests, well, what about after the sentencing? You require or allow the victim to sound off to the wrongdoer. Does that make you feel better? If you make the person cry or try to reach out to them and make them realize what they've done, like maybe there could be some value even to the wrongdoer, him or herself, and arguably to the victim or victim's relatives. But she says, no, really the victims just want to affect sentencing. They probably wouldn't be that interested in, you know.
But also the point of justice isn't to give something to victims, properly conceived. I mean, if it's retributionist, then it's definitely designed that way. But properly conceived, it has all those other functions. So reform or deterrence or whatever.
But isn't that exactly at the heart of a lot of victims' advocacy? I mean, on the one hand, there is what seems to be not such a bad thing, the idea that part of the process of the justice system would be to provide an outlet for victims to speak. But to the extent that you want victims' rights to be taken into account, that is, it's hard to not understand that as being the retributive part of it. Because in principle, right, isn't the justice system itself, that is acting on behalf of the victims?
I don't think so. I think properly conceived, it's acting on behalf of society as a whole. It's not acting on behalf of specific victims. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. And I guess that's the thing that a lot of victims' rights folks, especially in extreme ways, they have just a hard time mm-hmm. saying that, well, it's about, on balance, society. So that means taking into account the rights and needs of the offenders. Right.
They would have to make an argument that there is some place for retribution. And there probably are some interesting and strong arguments that a retributionist, she doesn't really.
She does.
She does a little bit. You know, she gives a little bit of a summary of a few different.
Yeah. She tries to refute them. Obviously, their analyses are probably half a dozen different analyses.
Right. That even if you don't have the revenge fantasy that somehow the murdered person is going to be restored, the idea that there's a cosmic balance that needs to be leveled out, she just thinks is an obvious fantasy, like that's not something that you have to give an argument against.
Yeah, I think the cosmic balance is derivative of all the status stuff. So that's my problem with that. In other words, there may actually be something that's so genuinely psychologically satisfying about revenge or retribution that it's worthy of our consideration. It doesn't have to be rational, right? Hunger is not rational, but it doesn't mean it's irrational to satisfy hunger. It could be rational to satisfy revenge fantasies. Now, I don't think it is. I just think we have to say why.
Right. She has apparently another whole book where she gives her theory of justice. And so she kind of sums it up by saying, look, I'm basically some sort of utilitarian, but built into her concept of the good that she's a million utilitarian as opposed to a Bentham utilitarian, in that there's a whole lot of distinct things that are built into the end state that is supposed to be maximized. And a lot of them are inviolable rights and issues of autonomy and dignity and things. So those all get built into what you're trying to maximize. So what you're suggesting, Wes, is she seems to have a pretty flexible, we need to maximize opportunity. It ends up being a pretty extensive welfare-y list such that to really address it, you'd have to eradicate poverty, that we've been sitting back in all these, just like we were saying at the beginning, to really make the elevators work properly, to make the people work properly, you have to fix these systemic problems, which doesn't necessarily mean communists make everybody equal, but it does mean having adequate funding for lots and lots of things.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking seriously the idea that that's the object of society, not necessarily to make people better, but to provide for their flourishing, which is not the way we've set things up.
But so maybe you think that one of the things that needs to be respected is this satisfactory feeling we get out of revenge. If you think that that is not itself a vice, then it could be that maybe it's even necessary to the good life to have that satisfied in certain circumstances.
Suppose we are just so constituted that when someone does wrong to us, that there's no way for us to recover, that we really can't recover as people. You know, we talk about the trauma of victims, that there's really no way for us to recover unless we get this retribution. And it doesn't matter if there's a cosmic underpinning to this or not. It's just basic psychology. Maybe that's just the way we're wired. In which case, then I think you have to think harder about that. And in the end, it's probably the case that even if that's true, the larger constructive goals of society outweigh that, right? And that's really the way societies sort of trend, right? Are their punishments get less harsh as they develop over time? It's sort of a matter of self-restraint, as Nietzsche describes it in The Genealogy of Morals, and that's the strength of a society. Or the less harsh the punishments are, then the stronger the society is, and so on. But in general, we probably don't want to like whitewash what we're doing. We're giving up something, right? It costs us something. If we are so constituted that we really need that on some level, then we're giving up something important, and it changes the account.
So her main, I think, concession to the retributivists is that we're not simply forward-looking and treating the actions of people who have done serious wrong like you would a tiger who just happened to tear into a victim. It's not merely unfortunate that this thing happens. She thinks it's essential to make a statement that this kind of action is wrong, a shared understanding of what is wrongful and what is not, that that's sort of a necessary to the bonds of trust that she thinks is one of the things that is necessary for a good society, right? To have faith in your public institutions.
And for moving forward, right?
Uh-huh. So there are a number of ways that you could express that. And maybe the problem with the mass murderer example that you gave, Wes, is that it does not clearly enough with the person bitching about not having the most recent Xbox, that is not sufficiently making a social statement that this was wrong.
Yeah. And you probably also have to come to the point of understanding that you might not get that out of everybody. I mean, he could just be a sociopath in which he would never admit that it was wrong.
And then we also have to ask the question of why, and I think she does this a little bit, but what's the relationship between treating him in a certain way and making the statement that something is wrong? Is there really a link there? You know, so.
And also, how much does it being made clear that it's wrong require the acknowledgement of the perpetrator? In some cases, you can see, especially these intimate relations and stuff like that, moving forward does. But in these big, broad social justice cases like apartheid, that seems like there's something like that that needs to be done. But in this case, it's pretty clear to me, at least, that even if he doesn't think that what he did was wrong, there's plenty of people that think what he did was wrong, right? It's not like there's not a normative question there.
Right. It's already agreed on the society.
Yes. Yes.
So in this case, that's not really necessary. The case where it's really more necessary to think about stuff like that is like emerging things like sexual harassment or hate crimes. In particular, we want to say, she's saying that we're kind of, it's a political action to be saying, hey, we're acknowledging that this thing you might not have even thought was wrong, Bill Cosby. But in retrospect, like we really got to establish that you can't just do that for as long as you did and get away with that. That would be establishing a bad precedent.
I think she would even say it stronger, which was that even if it's the case that our justice system has gone a long road for being able to figure out how to deal with such things, the fact that things that you keep under wraps like that generally aren't the kinds of things that you're doing because you think they're a good idea or that you don't, that you don't understand that lots of people think that they're wrong. It's hard to imagine that he or anybody else who drugs somebody and then force themselves on them sexually doesn't understand what they're doing would be at least judged as wrong by most people. Even if they somehow torture themselves into thinking that it's okay, which is not clear to me that they would even be able to do that.
Well, they have to convince themselves they're in title to it for some reason or other.
Yeah, well.
No one knowingly does evil.
So the shape of her argument, though, is to say, yes, we have to acknowledge that something that we have decided as a society that this is wrong. But then the rest of the argument is saying why particular punishments, humiliations, why those things do not do the job. They are not necessary. They are not sufficient for showing that the thing is wrong. I don't know. I'm always just suspicious in general of we need to, as a unified society, convey this message, you know, that this thing is wrong. Like, just fix the problem. Just do the forward-looking stuff that you're talking about. Why the society, through governmental action, should be having to make announcements about moral issues in this way. I just don't think that's necessary. I think that's something the culture takes care of. It's something that those kind of feed into what we make a law in the first place. It is not then, if you end up displaying mercy in some particular case, I would look at the concrete effects of a particular decision along those lines.
Yeah, and if there were a pill that cured people of their criminality, right? And for each whatever category of criminality, the right thing would just be, you know, when someone murders someone, you give them that pill. And there's an acknowledgement of the wrongness of the act there, because when you correct someone, when you transform them into something better, you're acknowledging that the thing that they were was not good.
Or maybe give them booster shots in advance to that pill so they don't have to kill somebody.
You're vaccinated when you're a child.
Preemptive lobotomies for everyone. No one will be violent. That's probably not true. I don't know enough about lobotomies.
Well, you lose all motivation. So it can be helpful in refraining from murder.
You could be helpful to other people who want to kill.
You could just strap them into a chair and force their eyeballs open and expose them to incredibly horrible things until they their minds change.
You could be a murderer's right-hand vegetable. You
can make them watch all of Trump's speeches. Wow. Speaking of bringing rage and the whole thing that Martha is arguing against, enshrining it in public policy. All right, I think we have hit everything. It's a big book, and every single chapter wades into a big minefield of stuff. I mean, we didn't even talk about her intimate relations chapter much, where she really gets all psychology and relationship psychology. You know, so I could see a lot of places where if we narrowed in on some particular thing, we would learn some interesting things or have things to debate about. And likewise, in the revolutionary justice chapter, the one after the one that we've been mostly discussing today, just the relative status of, she actually is not entirely in favor of nonviolence. Like, of course you can defend yourself if somebody is behaving violently toward you. It's the non-anger part that she is really insistent on, that's the main thing. So she kind of compares Gandhi and MLK and Nelson Mandela and the things they thought about the relative status of those two things. But she was kind of irritated by the Gandhi, you know, oh, just let the soldiers cut you down. Anyway, all that deserves a lot more discussion. It's just a very rich book, so I definitely recommend it for folks. And it's just so conversational. And, you know, if you found Plato's Sophist or Hegel's Logic to be too nitpicky or difficult to get through, this is a great alternative.
I love The Sophist. Anyway, that's not relevant, but can't help it.
The book is really well written and easy to read, but not trivial in any way. It's well worth reading.
Unless you're Wes and then you think it sucks.
No, it doesn't suck. It's not my cup of tea.
I thought you liked the book, but there's more stuff to do on it. You don't have to think it's the whole answer to everything.
I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad book. I have my own particular interests.
We know that you're particular, Wes.
Yes, I'm not. To me, in terms of the content, it just has to be thought-provoking and draw me into these discussions in an entertaining way. That's why I would, as a modern philosophy book, regard this as something I would recommend. So almost a lot of it is on stylistic basis rather than content. There's a lot of rich content to it, whether you would get better accounts of the emotions or of many of these things from other sources. I don't know. I don't see myself personally, though I'm definitely open to reading more of her stuff, but racing out right now to get her book on justice and her book on the emotions, and let's have three more episodes on her. I was not like excited to that extent, despite her being a charming and wonderful interview.
This really is a book for public consumption, and it does a really good job of communicating difficult ideas to the general public. So I recommend it as well.
Next time, we're going to read some Levinas, speaking of over-the-top, difficult language philosophy. At least one of the essays we're going to read is Ethics as First Philosophy. For an accurate list of everything that we read in advance of it coming out, you can look at our partiallyexaminedlife.com/upcoming. I really want to thank everybody that has become a Partially Examined Life citizen or otherwise donated money to us or used our Amazon link to do their Amazon shopping, which is a way of giving us a cut of everything you purchase without any cost to you, or signing up for our Patreon page or any of this stuff. I will say that we've gotten so many members that I've just found it overwhelming to read the names every time. So I'm not going to do it. I'm done. I can't do it. And in fact, the fact that we were excluding the $5 a month people, you know, there have been people that signed up for $5 a month for 2 years. So those people have given way more than somebody that gave $10 or $15 on one occasion whose name I did read. So because of the injustice and overwhelming work involved in this, I hope that not hearing your name on the air does not make you less likely to contribute. We've got a Facebook group that all the postings for this episode get posted to. We would love to hear from all of you. Unless you're really irascible. Then keep it to yourself.
Hey, one last thing. The song you're about to hear is some lyrics crafted directly in response to this episode, and I put them over a pre-existing track that had been created for a disco video game by Sean Beeson, a great composer that I interviewed for my Nakedly Examined Music podcast. His episode is not yet posted, but look for that and look at SeanBeeson.com to check out his music.
Good night, everybody. Thanks.
Good night. Good night.
I don't need your berating, cause anger has no place in my heart. I don't need your forgiveness, transactional forgiveness. I won't pony up a place in my heart. I don't need you to trap me, to butter up and slap me, cause anger has no place in the hearts that I love. I know that I've left a malfunctioning mess, but anger has no place in this conversation. Rage released is still rage. Rest in peace until you surpass all rage. Don't you dare forget me. Your forgiveness, your arrogant forgiveness. I don't need you to tell me that I'm good enough or wrong. I don't need you to judge me, even if you love me. Love should preclude all this need to be strong. I don't need you to be big enough, because even that's not big enough to smother rage before it starts to burn between us. You shouldn't have to let me off, because you'd never be set off if you were the type that could learn. Rage release.